Our guest today is Greg Pask. He is an insect neurobiologist at Middlebury College studying how insects use smell to communicate with each other. In particular, his research focuses on using a range of techniques in molecular biology, genetics, electrophysiology, and animal behavior to understand the mechanisms by which ants detect social cues and how this is necessary for maintaining successful ant colonies. Can we start by talking about the idea of a superorganism? So organisms are really just a collection of living cells organized in a highly complex manner. Do you consider ant colonies as an organism that exists on a larger scale, made of a collection of living organisms also organized in a complex manner?
Yeah, it's this really nice, like the superorganism idea is just this like next level, like the higher level beyond the organism, which is just very nice. And it really gets to kind of the social, the eusocial group's ability to kind of have this very clean and clear-cut, oftentimes clear-cut division of labor, in which that superorganism, its reproductive organs are the queen or whoever, however many reproductive individuals there are. You'll have like the mouth parts might be the ones that are going out and foraging. There might be certain functionalizations of that organism that are caring for the brood. So it's just a really nice nice way to kind of recognize the teamwork, the coordination, the altruism that takes place, and that you have all these organisms that give up their ability to reproduce themselves.
When you take a step back from looking at all the individual ants, do you see the colony itself as a single unit?
I do. I just took care of all of our ants in our ant chamber last week or yesterday as well. And it's, you kind of just think about them as their own certain colonies. I know that this one is really good at hunting crickets very quickly. I have certain fledgling colonies that I'm starting now. So yeah, we kind of basically think about them as that colony level organization. And also because there's so many ants in there that it's hard to even get to the individual level. You're like, all right, well, that's this colony. Or this colony I know really likes to break down the barrier that we have around their nest box. And they try to escape as soon as we lift the lid. So there's all sorts of different kind of personalities that we tend to think about in the context of the colony.
Do you consider these ant colonies as intelligent? Like there's an idea of swarm intelligence, which is a form of intelligence where you have intelligent collective behavior that emerges from like self-organizing decentralized agents. And this is what you get with ant colonies. So how intelligent are they?
So I think I always get this question a lot of like, you know, it sometimes it starts with like, do insects even have brains, which is a heartbreaking question to have to deal with. But how intelligent they are intelligent as they need to be. And that's evolution has selected for that over millions and millions of years, in which, you know, they are able to communicate just the things that they need to communicate. And they're very effective at doing that. Ants are one of the dominant animal groups on the planet for a reason. This highly coordinated behavior works really well in their favor, and they are able to do some amazing things. Oftentimes we'll see some ants that are by themselves and we might think that it's doing something that doesn't seem to be as intelligent. But when you think about, like you were saying, the swarm intelligence, the hive mind, that's when you kind of get into the full functional. You don't need to have individuals with all the information, but a free flow of information between those and distribution of tasks can accomplish a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, even with that, there's amazing ants that at the individual level that do things that I don't think humans could do easily. There's these desert ants that are able to count their steps and kind of do vector integration. I don't know if you've heard of this before or not, where ants in the desert can't use like the tried and true, like reliable, like trail pheromones that they lay on there. It's so hot so that they'll kind of volatilize pretty quickly and leave. And it's a bunch of sand and that sand moves. So any sort of trail would kind of be dispersed very easily. And they allowed these ants to go foraging in, like, they would go in this huge foraging path that would move left, right, back, forward, and then find food. And then they'd go directly back to their nest and find it every time. So this observation was a real interesting one. So some of the scientists working on this then decided, let's cut their legs in half once they find that food source, or put them on stilts after they find that food source to see, how are they doing this kind of path integration model, to be like, all right, I took 5 steps east, 10 steps north, and all these things, and then work it back to a single vector back home. And they found that the ones with the short, stumpy legs went about like half the distance to the nest and started searching around and trying to find their nest, because that's they knew how many steps in that direction. It's just now their steps were a lot shorter. The ones with stilts went past the nest and tried to find it. So it's a really cool thing. And then when you left them with the stumpy legs, I mean, just the fact that you can cut the legs in half and that they'll still walk and forage isn't just an amazing thing in and of itself. But the stumpy legs and the long-legged ones, they let them just kind of do the foraging with those legs, and they found the nest every time on the way back to show that they are actually counting their steps. Now, if you put me out in a field and had me walk around in all these different directions, and it's, a featureless field, I could not find the exact route back to where I started without the use of landmarks and things like that. So it's a pretty amazing thing that they can accomplish at the individual level. And then now think about all the individuals having that ability.
Now we have Google Maps to deal with that.
Right? I feel like I've gotten worse with
Yeah.
directions.
So you mentioned division of labor. What does a successful ant colony actually look like? How complex is it?
Yeah, and some of this depends on the species of ants, that the kind of division of labor that occurs. I think one of the example, like most well-known examples of an ant colony division of labor, is a leafcutter ant colony, in which you have certain ones that are going out chomping the leaves down to get bring back and feed their fungus garden. So you have different ants that would tend to the fungus garden, take these the vegetation that is foraged for, and then feeding their fungus. You have ones that are riding and help directing that. You also have these small little ants that are helping protect the larger ones from parasitic flies. So they all have their, everything, everybody in the colony has a job to do, and they're working together to do it. And they're communicating along the way to pull that off. And then you go back inside the depths of the colony in the nest, and there's a reproductive who is constantly producing eggs that'll fulfill those future roles later on. And there's just a lot of morphological differences in that. Other ant colonies, like some smaller ones, will not have these different kind of morphological differences between their different castes. So then you actually sometimes will have kind of a change as they move throughout. And I know this is a question for later, but it kind of relates now. But you'll have certain ants that will kind of change the job that they do over their lifetime. So early on, they're in the nest, taking care of the brood, the larvae, the pupae, helping them out, feeding them, all that good stuff. And then maybe as they get older, they're starting to do some more work within the nest, kind of nest maintenance, maybe digging, new tunnels, finding new places, maintaining the waste in there. And then as they get older, they tend to kind of do more outside tasks, whether it's foraging for food or defending against any sort of threats. So sometimes it's different. Sometimes you're like genetically like predetermined to and morphologically determined based on the genetics to do certain things in that colony. And sometimes your job changes as you get, quote unquote, promoted.
Before we talk more about ants, do you think human societies are super organisms too?
It's a something that comes up a lot. If we behaved like ants, I think we wouldn't have as much conflict within our colony of superorganism. The fact that there's not as many people who are like a lot, oftentimes in humans, the people who are willing to give up their reproductive ability are not necessarily taking care of the offspring of those who did not choose to do that. So that's kind of where it falls short. You don't have this cooperative care of the young. That really works out. Oftentimes, if you've detached from the idea of having your own children, you're not really raising other people's children. Now, you do have uncles and aunts kind of taking care and family helping family out, but oftentimes it's not at the same level of the ants and wasps and bees and all these great eusocial organisms. And even like naked mole rats are a great example of a mammalian system that is a great eusocial structure.
So are societies qualitatively different from like ant colonies, or are we more sophisticated versions?
Now you're getting into my opinions on humans as a species. It's just really complicated. Humans seem to have kind of wanted to build these group societies and communal living, but also have a harder time working together relative to the ants, where there's, sometimes communication within the human society is not the clearest. Whereas ants typically have pretty good communication between those in the colony and across the other colonies. We could learn a lot and improve ourselves as a people.
So yeah, we know that human societies can be very fragile and not sustainable, and many have collapsed in the past. Do ant colonies collapse too?
Ant colonies will, tend to have like collapse as far as their their queen goes. So, but they have backup plans to kind of seed new colonies throughout. So oftentimes we'll have a queen ant who has not mated yet. She'll go out on a mating flight. She'll leave her home nest. She'll mate with a male or multiple males, most likely. And she'll store that sperm within a special organ inside her. And that's all the sperm she needs for the rest of her life. And some of these live up, 20, 30, 30 years as queens. And then she'll go down, she's now a foundress. She's going to start a colony. She chews off her own wings because she doesn't need them underground. And she'll start making her colony, and all those fertilized eggs will come out. Now, as she ages and her colony is growing, she won't have as much help, she won't have as much sperm to keep going, and she'll start to senesce and die. She won't live forever. So she'll start having males and unmated queens, like new queens that she's developing in her colony. They will leave the nest and start to pass things forward. There's other species of ants, like one of the ones that we study primarily is the Indian jumping ant. And we like to think of those colonies as immortal, in that when the true like founding queen dies, the other workers will kind of have this big like dueling tournament. It's a bunch of like dominance behaviors and aggression behaviors, though not fatal. And they will decide who becomes the next reproductive, this kind of pseudo queen, which we call the Gamergate. And she will continue to lay offspring, not at the higher rate that a true queen would, but she can propagate that colony's offspring and keep them going for a long time. So as they're also spreading colonies elsewhere, that original colony continues. So that's kind of one of the nice differences in how sometimes it lasts and sometimes it will have to fade away but spread elsewhere.
One more question about human societies. You mentioned that we have a lot to learn. So what are the main lessons that we should learn from how to be a functioning society from ants?
Well, communal living takes a lot of good communication. So ants that are unable to easily communicate with each other, scientists like to do a lot of different manipulations to mess this up, and the whole colony often really struggles a lot in that context. Communication is key. For us, it's mostly spoken, but also just other actions that we do can say a lot about what we're trying to convey. Whereas in ants, it's largely chemical communication, but there's other things in terms of tactile communication, vibrational communication, and sometimes visual. Though not some ants don't even have eyes, so there's no visual component there. So kind of learning to very clearly convey what an individual is trying to do for the good of the colony and communicate that. The fact that we could, if we were an ant and we followed a trail pheromone from our nest mate, we know that there's something good at the other end. It's like this kind of chemical democracy that they call it, that all the ants that go there and find like a really good food source lay down more trail pheromones. It's kind of like a little vote that they say, hey, follow this path. Whereas if you walk outside as a human or go on the internet, so help you, that you find all sorts of things that are trying to, pull your attention away from things that you might not really need to do. So it's a muddier, like a lot of noise out there in terms of the things that we really need to do as humans. Other thing is that living together in societies, you have to really be clean and have good hygiene. Group living, sometimes if some sort of illness or disease infiltrates the colony, it can start to spread and take out the whole colony, whether it's a fungus, a viral thing. So taking care of any threats from the outside is a good thing. And for humans, coming out of slash still in the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, we seem to understand that quite well right now.
Yeah, it's ironic that like we've developed complex language, but still we're not as efficient at communication as ants.
Yeah, and their language is quite complex, though it's reliable. I think that's one of the things that humans sometimes our language is not as reliable as it should be.
Yeah, but I guess it might also like partly that the problems we try to solve in human societies are much more complex. That there's a lot more conflict because of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that make it hard for that comparison, but we can pull small things.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's talk about ants individually. So you mentioned that different ants have different roles. So what determines what role an ant plays in the colony?
Yeah, so sometimes it's something genetic in which there's some connections that say your mother, the founding queen, has had different genes that have picked up different sperm from different males. There sometimes are connections between that, in which the ones that were fertilized with sperm from some males tend to drift towards certain tasks versus others. That's some it's really kind of newer emerging research into that prospect. But typically, it's something more at the epigenetic level, especially during brood development. So, as ants are larvae, they get different kinds of food and different types of food and other things that are triggered hormonally that can set them on different trajectories to become different members of the colony, whether it's a big-headed, major worker or maybe even a super major that has these huge jaws. Most of the head is muscle. To be able to kind of defend against invaders, or maybe cut down large leaves, different things. So that sometimes, like kind of within the different castes of workers, you have different abilities there, kind of polytheism, different behaviors that can emerge. And sometimes it's genetic, sometimes it's temporal, like I mentioned before, as they age, they can change those roles. One of like the most well-known example of that is in honeybees, in which you have the early workers are taking care of the offspring. Next, you start building cells in the hive and the honeycomb, and then you start foraging later on. But yeah, it's there's all sorts of kind of epigenetic interest in seeing what factors regulate this and especially how diet plays into that, because there's also a big change of do you become an unmated queen, like a new queen that will leave.
How does the colony like ensure that you have the the correct distribution of different organisms with different, like, the appropriate roles. So why do you not get too much of one type of ant?
Oh, so for that, I mean, this is something that I think people have looked into. I'm not as familiar with it. The thing that comes to me is I remember playing Sim Ant, which was like an old computer game, like from the makers of like Sim City and things like that, in which on the left side there was a little slider that you could make large soldiers or workers, and you could skew that up and down. I'm not sure exactly of the way that the rest of the colony is able to do that, to distribute that. It's not something that would be regulated by the queen, but more so with kind of the treatment of the brood as they're developing to be able to do that. But honestly, I'm not as familiar with that side of the literature. You can imagine somebody taking away, like, hey, if you took away all the large workers, would they start to fill those in, or was that too much of a manipulation to come back from?
Yeah, that's super interesting. It's like, again, going back to like the hive intelligence, like an ability to compute and like ensure that the distributions are always appropriate.
Yeah, and one of the things, I mean, probably why I'm ignorant to that is because our colonies of ants that we use mostly have a single type of worker that can even go all the way up. That she's so plastic that she can go up to become the new queen if she needs to.
Oh, so there's less of it. So some ant colonies have less of a distribution of labor.
They will distribute it, but they can change. They'll kind of do whatever they need to, especially as they grow. Like there's certain colonies that we have in the lab that I know that there's certain individuals there that are the hunters. They will go out and get those crickets that I drop in the nest box immediately. And other ones that are just, you know, especially the younger ones don't really go out and engage with that. And they're just helping to take care of their you know, younger sisters and sometimes younger brothers.
Mm-hmm. So you also mentioned a reliable language that ants use. So how do ants communicate with each other?
Yeah, so this is, they have all sorts of different glands that they use to convey meaningful messages. Some come from the abdomen, some come from the head. And, you know, some classic ones would be a trail pheromone. Hey, there's food this way, follow this and you'll find some things. Other compounds might be an alarm pheromone. So there's some ants that will spray formic acid at, you know, any sort of, you know, threat that is invading their colony or their space. And that is a very reliable alarm pheromone signal that can cause some ants to run, other ants to swarm. Taking care of those ants can be a frustrating, because if one sprays you, all of a sudden you have ants climbing up your, you know, mounting a very aggressive response to your hands the entire time. And also the nice thing with that, with alarm pheromones, is like, say something came in and like killed one of your sisters. That is also a way to release that formic acid alarm pheromone. And then that can trigger that response as well. So sometimes it's actively released. Sometimes it's more passively released after you've been squished. Others, kind of a lot of the communication that can occur within like nestmate recognition is what we tend to focus on a lot of, these really waxy molecules that coat all insects. These are called cuticular hydrocarbons, and they're just very hydrophobic. Their main function, when you're small, it's very easy, like the surface area to volume ratio is not in your favor, and you might release water too much, and desiccating inside is not a good thing for insects. So a lot of ants will have these very waxy barriers that can protect from abrasions and whatnot, but mostly keep water inside to allow you to have your hemolymph be filled with water and your cells can function. Ants, bees, wasps, and termites, and a lot of other insects, but mostly the social insects, have kind of co-opted these types of molecules. So instead of having like a set amount of cuticular hydrocarbons, you'll have a huge amount of variation that sometimes can signal, you know, hey, I'm part of this colony or this colony of the same species. And otherwise, it'd be very challenging to differentiate between them. And it might be the same molecules, but all these different ratios that exist between on all the different individual molecules. Sometimes it might be the reproductive who so like a fertility signal. She is giving off like different types of cuticular hydrocarbons on her body and also depositing them on the eggs. So that's kind of like the queen stamp on the egg. But, hey, this egg was laid by the queen, not by some worker who might be trying to cheat the system and lay their own. So those kinds of things are really a lot for like nestmate recognition and establishing that division of labor.
So it's like an identity tag for like the species identity tag.
Exactly. I like to think, I like when I talk about this, I explain them as like little barcodes. So like different sections of that barcode convey different informations. Like, hey, I'm part of this colony and I do this kind of job. And this is actually, maybe there's a flexible region that is more for the individual, that they have some slight individual variation.
And they sense that through touch.
Yeah, so this is something that we've actually just been kind of getting into with scanning electron microscopy. We just had a preprint that came out on this on bioarchive. One of my students, this one of my students, Hannah, led the study with some other ones, Daphne and Zach, in which they looked at the antenna and found, like, a lot of times when you see two ants interact, they're touching each other with their antenna and it's kind of sampling each other. So they're kind of like the barcode readers in our minds. And we looked at those structures. And a lot of times when we think about antenna, we're thinking about smell and kind of different olfactory cues that come in. But it seems like some of these hairs that are on ants look very different from all these other insect species we've looked at, in which they might favor a more contact touch. They might have structures that kind of favor a contact and touch model of those CHCs, which aligns with some of the behavioral observations we've seen over, decades and decades of ant research, which is really kind of fun to see some of the structure match some of this behavioral function.
What does a structure that favors touch look like?
So increasing surface area is one that has really excited us. So things like a lot of the tips of these little hairs that are all over the antenna, and the ones that we know that will sense these waxy molecules for nestmate identification, they will kind of have like concave bits, like these concave depressions. Instead of just kind of being round and covered with all these pores that let odor come in, that it seems that the tips of those are really geared towards bringing all those molecules in. Is that we're still unsure if that is actually just like a pit that increases the surface area, or if it's actually a hole itself. In the common insect model of Drosophila, all your taste hairs, instead of having a bunch of hairs all over them or a bunch of holes all over them, they have a single hole at the very end, and that's where like sucrose and all these other tastings come in. So is that what we're seeing? We're still unsure, and it's an exciting thing. It's something that we're not necessarily equipped to go further with the equipment we have access to, but we're hoping that kind of putting it out there, others can start to explore this. And even since putting it on Twitter, it's been fun to see that groups from like mid-2000s would be like, we saw these cool hairs before. We didn't really have the resolution to get into it. So it's just kind of fun to connect with prior observations that people have had.
So with regards to the chemical pheromones, how comprehensive is our understanding of the neurobiology of that, and how well do we understand what pheromones signal what behavior?
Well, that's where like the logic in the neurobiology of it is somewhat challenging when we think about like nestmate recognition, because there's like so many moving parts. You can think about like every molecule that is on there kind of having like a slider, and like
Right.
how much does it need to match for somebody to say, hey, this is my sister versus this is an invading worker who's coming to take all my stuff. Whereas other things in terms of like a fertility signal seem to be pretty kind of single molecules can pull that off. You can kind of reduce the ovarian development of workers by having a single molecule present in the colony across ants, bees, and wasps. There's a nice paper that came out looking at that before. You can also have very clear responses to a trail pheromone that you can just kind of like take a single molecule and just like drag, you know, trace a line around a paper, and you'll see ants just kind of following that line. So there it's really clear cut. And then when we get, so that's the behavioral aspect, but the black box is the brain. So there's been a lot of work in some particular labs kind of looking at different regions of the brain that light up in response to these. So most of it's kind of pulling in signal from the periphery and kind of seeing this region called the antennal lobe, which is very comparable to the olfactory bulb in humans and other mammals and vertebrates, in which you have this large integration center of all the like neurons that are sensing these molecules come together and kind of summate all these responses. And you can kind of look at this activation pattern in the antennal lobe and kind of predict how an insect might respond to that. But in terms of kind of where these signals go after that, we know the regions of the brain that they go to, but not necessarily the exact mechanisms that follow after that. So there's a lot of rich frontiers in that realm as well. You have some that, like something like a colony odor, that's something that is probably learned and learned from the larval stage. And hey, this is mine versus other, whereas like something like an alarm pheromone or a fertility signal, that's something that you don't necessarily need to learn. You don't want that to be plastic. So sometimes that can skip the main learning center of the insect brain, the mushroom body, and go directly to downstream neurons that will, you know, propagate the appropriate behavioral response or physiological response.
Yeah. On the topic of like studying mechanism, so ants are not model organisms. So for those who don't know, model organisms are common species that scientists like to study, like fruit flies and mice. And there are a lot of advantages to studying these species. For example, you can have like comprehensive genetic catalogs to make studying certain mutants easier, like conditional mutants with these organisms are very relatively easy to make. So what would you say are the main difficulties with studying non-model organisms?
I mean, it's sometimes it seems like difficulties. Other times it seems like opportunities, in which a lot of times when we look at model organisms, they've been in the lab for, you know, sometimes like 60, 80 years, sometimes 100 years when we think about Drosophila. And it's, you can like, there's a lot of questions that have been addressed very thoroughly and has formed a lot of the foundation of what we kind of assume is across all the organisms that is a model for. But as one who studies insects and teaches about insects, like I find some of the most exciting things are the exceptions to the rules and having inroads to all the different ways that organisms have changed to adapt to their certain environments, so the things that they need to do is really nice. And it can be difficult because sometimes the expectations of working with non-model organisms more so align with model organisms. Like, oh, well, you know, we've seen people do this kind of technique in flies. Why can't you do it in ants? So like, it's just like, for us, it's like as electrophysiologists where we're like, oh, just stick an electrode in the hair there and you can get the same sort of response. And it's like, yeah, but in Drosophila, there's 1 to 4 neurons in that hair that we can easily distinguish between. In ants, it's over 100. There's certain challenges that can come from that. But again, I really like to think that as more groups start to kind of change how we view model organisms and non-model organisms, like mosquitoes are becoming a model more so these days because of all the genetics and the genetic work that has been put into that. So as we keep trying to push forward the frontiers of what we consider a model organism, one of our main insect species or ant species that we work in has already had one of its main olfactory genes knocked out. And so trying to use that to maybe get like a genetic handle into making all these sorts of manipulations is not as far off as one would have thought in the pre-CRISPR era. Now, like the fact that we have CRISPR that can, you know, these nice molecular scissors that can help us access all these different genomes and edit them, you know, dangerous and exciting at the same time as we get in there. We can start asking a lot of directed, targeted questions. But I think there's still so much in our non-model organisms that we can just avoid the genetics altogether and still learn so much just based on some of the tried and true observational techniques and physiological techniques where you don't necessarily need to get to the genomic level yet.
Mm-hmm. Do all, like amongst the ant community of neurobiologists, do you all study like the same species of ants or?
No, and that's again, one of the better things. There's over 12,000 species of ants at this point. And that's just like, you know, when we think about like described species, there's so many, you know, estimates would have it way more. And some of the beauty is that a lot of different ants have been and studied for different questions. Some ants are preferentially used because they behave very well in the lab, like our Indian jumping ants, and there's the clonal raider ant that Daniel Cronauer at Rockefeller University's lab is looking at a lot. They behave very well in the lab, and like the clonal raider ant just makes clones of itself. You don't have to worry about like the queen going on this mating flight, which is very hard to simulate for it. Whereas we can have workers that turn into reproductives in our colonies with the Indian jumping ants. So we never have to go collect them again. We can just continue to propagate them. Very similar to like mammalian cell culture. We can just kind of split off groups and they'll start new colonies and be fine. But there's a lot of benefit to a lot of the field work that people have done. Some of the ants that we've looked at recently with our like scanning electron microscopy study, we just walked outside and found. Which is a very nice thing to look at. It's, you know, it's a very common ant species that has been thoroughly described, so we can start there. But when you think about all these cool studies that go when people like actually go to the tropics where there's new and exciting ants, and the, hey, maybe some of the things that we learned in the lab don't necessarily apply in like a natural setting, which is nice and exciting. And that kind of diversity and model or in, you know, non-model or model or study organism is really important.
Wait, did you say there was a type of ant that clones itself?
Yes. There's a clonal raider ant. I mean, males in social insect colonies oftentimes are not as important. They're kind of just, you know, for ants, they're kind of just flying sperm packets. Clonal ants have just kind of gotten rid of the males altogether and will just produce clones of themselves and can persist that way.
So like genetically identical ants, right?
Yeah, which again, if you're going to pick certain organisms to then hopefully do future genetics work, having a clonal is a big advantage.
Mm-hmm. Right, so you mentioned a few experimental techniques already. Like you mentioned studying which brain regions are lit up. That seems like an fMRI.
It's very similar, yes. Yeah, it's all calcium imaging, yeah.
So what is the range of experimental techniques that you use to study ants?
Yeah, so we do a lot of different techniques, and we kind of have it divided in different regions of the lab. We do a lot of molecular biology and cloning of ant olfactory receptor genes. So we're actually interested in genetic function of these smell receptors. And we move a lot of clear liquids with DNA in tubes a lot and use bacterial transformation to get them, you know, essentially turn the bacteria into genetic factories for us and then pull things back out. Other techniques we do is like once we have those genes identified, we've developed this kind of system a couple of years ago to put them in, and other people had used the system for other insects, but to take ant receptor genes out because it's very complicated to study them in the ant themselves, the single gene function. And we put them into Drosophila actually. So we have a whole like Drosophila genetics husbandry side of the lab where we are taking our ant receptor gene, putting it in a fruit fly, and then expressing it in a certain subset of neurons that we are interested in looking at. So we can have this little pipeline where we clone a gene, put it in the fly, and then we take that fly and we put it on an electrophysiology ray, which is just a fun way to say that we're poking electrodes into things and seeing how they respond to, you know, certain stimulations. So we'll take a little tiny fruit fly, we'll shove it in a little clear plastic pipette tip and poke out just the antenna of this fly. And then we stick one electrode into the eye, one electrode into a single hair on the antenna of the fruit fly. And then once that happens, it's so joyous because we have a guitar amplifier hooked up and you can hear the sounds of those neurons popping and firing in real time. And then once that happens, then we can just puff different pheromones on, like ant odorants that we're interested in, and see what kind of response they have. And hey, this fly couldn't respond to this before, and now we added this ant gene into it, and now all of a sudden it gives this response to this, you know, waxy compound on the surface of the ant. And now we've kind of decoded some of that olfactory system and how that works for the ant. We also have a lot of things where we actually studied the ants by themselves. We'll do scanning electron microscopy to get these really nice zoomed in images of all the little microstructures and features of these sensory surfaces and how we can understand a lot from them. And then also we have a whole ant chamber that we have some behavioral tests going as well.
So what actually does an ant lab look like? Like, how many ants do you keep?
So right now we are growing our ant colony population. Right now we have, I think we have 12 or 13 different ant colony boxes. And they range in size. Some of them have like 40 to 50 ants. This is a small, the colonies that we keep, this species has kind of smaller colonies. And some of those are just like four ants large. We have four that are growing up and these are these splits that we moved from other colonies and that they're now have their own offspring and they'll start their own colonies very soon. So we're kind of just dividing them and letting them, you know, kind of propagate that way. So yeah, typically that's the kind of numbers we've fluctuated. We've had 20, 25 colonies going at a time. It gets to be a lot. It's good to scale how many ant colonies you need based on the experiment, like how many you have based on the experiments that you need them for. So that's what our ant, like, so we have this whole like chamber that is sealed so that ants don't escape because they are non-native to this region. The world and the USDA kind of regulates that we keep them in check. So we have like certain features that you might think would be like beneficial to have in an ant chamber, like, oh, a sink. It's like, no, that drain has to be not there and sealed up. Or something like the ventilation has to have screens with fine enough mesh that the ants can't escape. We have to have gaskets sealing all the doors so it's, you know, nice and tight and secure, which is good. Issues with that. Insects escaping have been a major problem for a lot of invasive species over the decades.
Yeah. And how big are these ant chambers?
This ant chamber is probably about, I think it's 9 feet, like 9 by 6. So it's not too big. It's just these small chamber, like our ant nest boxes are kind of smaller, so we can just kind of stack them on top of each other on a metal rack. The ant chamber needs to be pretty clean because if you have an escaping ant, you want to be able to find it immediately. You can't have a lot of clutter around and everything. So, yeah.
Hold on, I was just converting feet into meters. Those are pretty big. That's pretty big.
Yeah, and other labs that we've collaborated with in the past have much larger chambers, but they have hundreds of different colonies that they're propagating.
And how different is the life of an ant in the lab and in the wild?
So some of that can depend on, you know, we're giving them largely kind of a single food source But we're also protecting them from all sorts of flooding and other, environmental risks that they can experience out in the wild. So I think for some species, ants tend to, ant colonies tend to persist better in the lab. But other species, like there's some factors that we're not accounting for, we're not able to do, and in the wild, you'll find that they thrive way more. So it depends on the species, but we can get ant queens that can last a long time in the lab. Like you can go out and collect a queen right before she founds the colony, and then she can start propagating. And there's enough food because you're providing enough food. There's no famine conditions for them, so you can make the lab colonies quite happy. Though you do have to worry about, maybe there's some natural symbionts there that help protect against fungal infections, and they didn't develop those in the lab and whatnot. So we try to keep things just as clean, but honestly, the ants can keep themselves clean like a lot better than we can. Part of the ant care is they have like all the trash, like they're, any sort of dead individuals of the colony who would be ripe for some sort of fungal growth or infection afterwards. They move those into the corner. They move all the prey carcasses, like the old food that they're not eating, into the corner. So taking care of them is quite easy because you just kind of they put all their trash out on the corner for you, and you just scoop it out yourself.
So how do you navigate the trade-off between like studying ants in the wild and studying ants in the lab? Like, is there a worry that what you're studying is not ethologically relevant?
The ecological relevance is tough. And one of the things that we are able to kind of help ourselves with is we're mostly looking at kind of peripheral sensory systems. So, all right, how are these neurons in the antenna responding? And able, it's kind of more of the sensation instead of the perception side of things. So from the sensory capabilities, we don't believe that that should change that much from a lab context versus a wild context. So that helps. The other things that, like when we get into some of the more behavioral aspects of these, we can worry about how they behave. Like even the fact, like one of the things that we developed is this device that allows us to like monitor the ants when we're not there, because the ants that we have are so visual. They have these nice big eyes. They're visual hunters. And when we walk into the ant chamber, they know we're there. They are looking at us. Some ants will be looking at us and like shaking their abdomens as like a threat display. To us, to me as a dog owner, it looks like they're like little dogs and they're like wagging their tails at us and happy to see us. But I will move from side to side and I'll see little ants, their heads kind of following us as we go. So how much of an effect does that have on their behavior? We're not as we're, I think it has an effect, and we try to minimize that as much as we can. But at the same time, the things that we want to look at in behavior is kind of more clear-cut things like, is the colony making a new reproductive? Are they dueling because they can't detect that there's a queen around anymore? Like these are fundamental things that are not as be not as manipulated by our presence or even just the presence of being in the lab. This is basic survival of their colony and of their species that should be pretty strong and kind of hard to mess with. But we play that, play that trade-off a lot.
Do you also study ants in the wild?
Not as much, other than just kind of taking ants from the outside and throwing them on the SEM to see what their antenna look like. That's been the extent of our field work with ants. We do field work, we're starting to do some field work with other insects, but not as much in ants.
So what do you think are the biggest experimental challenges in your research?
The biggest challenges would be trying to kind of understand what kind of connections are being made from the sensation side to the physiological or behavioral response. Like that black box of the brain, is is something that would be very nice to know what's happening in the as we're doing these kinds of experiments. In terms of like the specific challenges to some of the experiments we run, one of the larger things that we deal with is a lot of the insects that have been studied before with like their olfactory receptor function. They might have, you know, 50 to, you know, 80 receptors that they use. Ants have 350 to 400 olfactory receptors that, you know, are presumably expressed and have functional roles. So while other ones, we can try to like take a chunk out of those and look at like expression of these genes and, hey, how do these genes kind of function in terms of the larger context of the organism? But we can still only take small bites of the apple and understand how that whole system works for us or for the ant.
So that black box of the brain, how black is the box like relative to our understanding of mice and Drosophila?
It's pretty dark and dim in there based on like compared to Drosophila and mice, purely just because there's just been so many, you know, other labs looking at that kind of research. So for me, it's nice because it's like open pastures and like new frontiers, but it's also, there's not as much to go on. So like protocol development, getting new insights into how to pull this off, maybe from those other insects and be like, well, this might not work. Like even just like the, from the standpoint of dissecting a brain in a moth or a Drosophila, like a fly compared to an ant, ants have really hard cuticle. And I remember one of my former colleagues was sitting next to me dissecting brains from Drosophila and I was dissecting brains from ants. And she was like, are you just grinding your forceps together? And I'm like, no, I'm trying to break into this cuticle so I can get the brain out, where it's so easy in some other insects. So that's kind of some of the challenge. And even just having maps, like I know that in rodents, there's like the big map of all the brain regions that you can flip through the page and like each page is a slice and it's very helpful. We have nothing near that in a lot of our non-model insects. But again, that's the fun. That's the fun of finding these things. You know, tracing a neuron and understanding its function in a non-model organism is super exciting and novel. Whereas if you did that in mice, it's probably already been done or close to have been examined already.
So it doesn't worry you that we're so far off with the ants?
It has to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. And it's kind of just the level of depth that, and that can come later. And more so when I think about what's been done in Drosophila and trying to apply that to ants, it gives me great comfort to know that there's other labs looking at it in wasps and looking at it in bees, things that are way closer to ants, and people who are looking at it in ants. Like that body of research, I think, can be way more telling. And still mix it with some of the things that we find in Drosophila, but we can have a lot of integration and insight from looking at more closely related organisms.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a device to monitor the ants, like in an automated way. So could you talk more about that?
Yeah, so we had this kind of fun little side project that stemmed from us just wanting to watch our ants around the clock. It's kind of like a huge, you know, it's coming from a place of huge nerddom and fandom. We just wanted to see what was happening. And we wanted to see, could we monitor our ants throughout the day, you know, nighttime, without having to come in ourselves and disrupt them, disrupt their behaviors. It's very rare for me to see a queen ant laying an egg, but I've seen it rarely. But by monitoring them automatically, I've seen them a lot more, which is nice. So we've made this device called the Pi Spy. It uses a Raspberry Pi computer, which is a very affordable, cheap, though it's hard to find them these days with like parts shortages and demand. But yeah, these very cheap and affordable and flexible computers that you can use to monitor and take video, like high quality video, of our organisms around the clock. And we started this trying to look at devices other people have made and found that a lot of them had a lot of extra kind of bells and whistles we didn't really need, and also had a lot more of a cost associated with those. Or wouldn't even run if you didn't have all the bells and whistles, you know, the different modular parts, it wouldn't even function. So we wanted to kind of make a stripped down version of it for our own usage, and then started to get to the point where, like, hey, well, this would be cool to share with others who might have the same needs, you know. And for me, as a researcher and an educator, I can think about, hey, this is a very simple use that you could use in like a teaching lab and build it there, not have high costs associated with that. Or also, if you wanted to use it in a research context and scale up, really get, instead of just two devices monitoring your organisms, you could have, at one time we had 16 running in parallel, watching 16 of our ant colonies as they were developing. So very simple kind of shell, but powerful. You can attach different things. We had fun with some Legos, and we built a like an infrared brake beam around a tube that was moving, having ants were moving between this tube from two chambers. And one of my students, Ben, built Legos up around the side to make the scaffold for this infrared like brake beam. And once an ant walked by and broke the beam, it would start taking video at that moment to see what they were doing. Were they going towards the food, going away from the food? Were they carrying food with them? Or like what size of food were they carrying back? So we could get all sorts of things automatically without us having to be there and just watching the entire time.
So this is a camera that you install inside the ant chamber.
Yeah, so it's mounted on kind of, we had a lot of fun with some engineers at my previous institution who built like a wooden scaffold for it with a lot of 3D printed attachments. And so the camera is kind of on the outside of the ant chamber, or we could actually fit it to the top of a chamber, like of the lid of a chamber, but we can put it in there and just watch things around the clock. And we also put in light control, so we could put red light on at night, so it seemed like it's, you know, nighttime and dark, but we could still have enough light to image and observe some of these nocturnal behaviors.
And once you've got the video, do you like automate the analysis as well?
So it's something that we can do. It's just kind of acquiring the video, and then we could take it into some sort of like, you know, tracking software program later on, whether it's, you know, we've done like very like in going with our open source, simple to use, we made sure that we use something like ImageJ to track some of these behaviors. But there's also really exciting things like Deep Lab Cut that you can kind of build these, you know, build these nice stick frames of your organism and track all sorts of fun behaviors. Some of this is really just going back to the power of just insect observation. There's one of my favorite ethologists and like entomologists is Jean-Henri Fabre, and he was back in the 1800s just observing insects and didn't really do that much of insect destruction or you know, sometimes he was manipulating things, but he learned so much just by observing. And I think sometimes that human element of observing is really important to kind of start to develop hypotheses that you can test later, or even just in the whole analysis of the behavior, right? Little things that you can see that the automated program like misses a point, or they swap of the tracking system, versus if you can have the time to watch them, it can be really powerful. That tends to be the issue. But yeah, one could kind of use these, you know, we're getting high quality, high resolution videos. You can take these videos into different tracking systems later on.
What are the most interesting or the biggest findings that you've found through these observations?
I think kind of what we're looking at is like kind of how fast it takes ants to realize that they're not part of a colony that has a queen. and like how quickly they start observing all the like how quickly they start engaging in this big dueling behavior. And then also we're using it this system in a lot of some like the other insects that we're studying. Something like we're doing a lot of things with fireflies and pheromones and seeing if, you know, when they're actually mating or attempting to mate with females, we can track that automatically without having us be there the entire time. So yeah, mating behaviors, even just and that like these dominance behaviors are very fun because it involves things like, you know, battering each other with antenna, biting, or just like straight up policing where they'll just carry an individual around for, you know, multiple hours up to like a day I've seen where it's just carrying it around nonstop, be like, no, you're not laying an egg in our colony. We already have a queen.
Yeah. So it seems like with the development of like machine learning and image recognition softwares, like there's been a lot of very interesting, sophisticated technologies to track animal behavior in a very accurate way. Do you think that automated tracking of animal behavior will be one of the most important experimental techniques of studying animals in the future in the more ethologically relevant way?
Yeah, it's it has so much potential, and I think what it really allows for is this automation can kind of take out some of the biases, the experimental bias of I think this should be doing this behavior, so I will classify this as the behavior I hope to see. Machine learning is great for kind of taking that out of the equation, and I love it for that regard. You know, one of the things that is somewhat tough, at least for some of the things that I've observed in like the machine learning for the behavioral outputs, is it is treating them as like stick figures, which there's so much more to the animal than that on most occasions. So there's some of a downside, but I think kind of doing these kind of studies in parallel or even using the machine learning to then get to the point where like, hey, this something interesting happened in this trial. It was engaging in this behavior and then got disrupted. Like, what happened? Then you go in and do the human learning, right? The human learning aspect is very important to see kind of how these animals are behaving in real time. And yet we get the benefit of kind of prepping things for machine learning by doing video, which can take away the presence, like our own presence in that process.
Yeah, I guess it's stick figures, but then there are also many smaller types of movements that it's easy to miss if you're just watching it as a human. So
Yeah, but I get it. I mean, there's a lot of times you'll just be observing ant behavior and they're just grooming the entire time. And being able to have that filtered out and sorted out for you can be very helpful.
yeah. So you mentioned fireflies. So, what other organisms are you interested in studying?
Yeah, we're really interested in a lot of these North American fireflies that we're looking at where they don't use like we everybody knows and loves fireflies for their flash signals that they release in the evening, but there's a lot of fireflies that I kind of just found a really cool collaborator and colleague before, and we started working on this together where these fireflies are out during the day, they don't have light organs as adults, and it's presumed that they use chemical communication, which is like my like hey pheromones, olfactory system, that's where I kind of get really interested. And trying to explore like how they're able to pull that off. And how are they communicating with each other Did they revert back to their old ways of communications like most beetles use the chemical pheromone, or did they have to, in that loss of light, did they have to evolve new ways to communicate that look different across different species that pulled that off? So we're very excited to kind of continue with that. Other beetles that we have, like longhorn beetles, are interesting to us. Sometimes these invasive beetles that are like, you know, bark, you know, boring, wood boring beetles that can be destroying a lot of trees, native trees here. Or just understanding from the basic evolutionary aspect of like how do different organisms that share the same ecological space, how can they communicate specifically with each other and not have, you know, noisy signals that then communicate to other species? So that kind of communication evolution interests us.
So like trying to decode like a chemical language across different insects. So can we talk about your scientific journey? How did you get interested in science and in particular this research area?
Yeah, I think a lot of the interest in science kind of paralleled some of the upbringing I had in terms of we were doing a lot of gardening when I was really young. I distinctly remember the Colorado potato beetle, which is like, a very tough pest species to deal with when growing potatoes or tomatoes in your garden. And going around and like monitoring them as a kid and like looking for eggs and larvae and removing them from our plants. I also really had strong science education growing up. And I was like a member of this this club called Science Olympiad, where we went to like state level competitions and did various tasks, like science related things. One was like Nature Quest, and it was like a lot of orienteering outside. And another was designing and kind of engineering a little kind of bottle that would be propelled by like baking soda and vinegar and see who could have it move the furthest through the tube of water. So little things like that, I think, were really cool and excited me. I loved kind of building and working with my hands and observing things in real time. And then kind of getting to this research area, I kind of feel like I fell into insects' sense of smell. When I was in undergrad, I took a course that was looking at neurotransmitter receptor structure and function. So kind of structure and function of different receptors in the nervous system. And I had not taken a neuroscience class at that point, but I was really interested. I was a biochemistry major. I was doing synthetic chemistry research. And I took that class and I was like, oh, receptors are really cool. I like this. We talked about enzymes all the time. And I kind of got into the receptor field. I'm like, this is like the same thing, like very similar questions, but at the membrane level. And I really liked the olfactory aspect of that as somebody who really likes cooking and kind of, playing with flavors and things like that. It was really fun. I remember in like my chemistry lab experience in my research, we would have this one product that had a nice minty, like an intermediate product that had a nice minty smell to it. So I'd always like smell that and be like, oh yeah, it's so good. I mean, in the safe, appropriate ways. So I went to grad school and there was a lab that worked on mosquitoes' sense of smell. And I was more there for the smell and the receptor side of it. And, the possibility of, developing and building a patch clamp electrophysiology rig. That was really fun. And that's what I did in my graduate days. And the mosquitoes and the insect thing was kind of secondary. And then I had the opportunity to actually go across the Atlantic and took a course on insect chemical ecology in Sweden. And it was like a 2-week program. It was really transformative for me to be like, hey, like there's a lot of cool things and cool space in insects. And I started to get into insects at a whole new level. Like I teach an entomology class here and I've never actually taken a formal class on insects in any way. And it's just all because I got really interested in it and wanted to learn and wanted to get to this level to not just think of these organisms we're studying as just, blobs of cells, but their specific nuances of how they arrived at that form. That was a really nice, and that's when I kind of started to get into the other insects and staying in insects. And then I moved from mosquitoes to ants, and then now we're venturing into all sorts of other beetles as well.
So if you could magically gain a skill or a set of knowledge to further your research, what would it be?
Well, I'm a huge comic book nerd, so I feel like I should say something about like being Ant-Man and talking, being able to communicate with insects, but not in the way that he typically has of like controlling them and having them do his bidding, but like just to be a part of the conversation, just know what's going on, hearing them be like, oh, watch out, there's this queen over there, so you better not lay an egg. Like that would be so cool to be able to understand their language in that sense. And it would be really great. I mean, so much of the work that we do is asking them what they smell in a very indirect roundabout way of pulling genes out of their antenna, functionally characterizing them in other flies. And if I could just ask them, or, you know exactly what they're responding to and what are the salient chemical cues that they rely upon, that would be way easier. And understand what they're saying, and it would potentially be my superhero origin story.
Maybe you realized that they were gossiping about you, actually.
Yeah, and yeah. Oh, that guy's coming in to take care of these ants again. Uh-oh. Everybody be cool. Yeah.
That would be your villain origin story.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what is your favorite part about doing science?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think one of my favorite things right now of doing science is kind of represents both sides of what I do in my current job. One is the fact that it's like different questions. It's so fresh. I'm asking and exploring different questions every day, even though they might have like a similar trajectory of where they're going. To be able to come in and perform experiments, design experiments, and just see what happens, and kind of knowing that I will still be able to do that in 5, 10, 20 years down the line, that that's still something that is a part of my job and what I like to do, is very exciting for me. The other aspect is that I run a lab here at a small liberal arts school where we have all undergraduate students. So bringing, you know, teaching and bringing students into the science lab and showing them and helping mentor them is really fun. It's to be able to kind of let them, watch them gain that independence and develop their own questions. And we have studies that have started that I'm like, ah, that won't work. And, you know, I don't know if that's worth us doing. And then to have the students drive it forward because they believe in it, and then it turns into a really cool story that we can share, is super fun. And I hope, like, that's what I experienced as a, you know, growing scientist. And I'm excited to be able to kind of contribute to that directly and bring more students into that fold. And just to see that doing science is way more exciting than reading about science in a textbook or hearing about it from a lecturing professor.
Wait, your whole lab is undergrads?
My whole lab is undergraduate students, yes. We have zero graduate students. Hopefully I'll be writing a grant proposal that'll get funded for a postdoc at some point, but that special aspect of the postdoc will be like working and mentoring undergraduate students. So hopefully like a postdoc who would want to get that experience to do the same type of job that I'm doing.
Wait, how big is the lab? How do you deal with teaching all the techniques and stuff?
So right now, I think the lab typically hovers at like a 4 or 5 student capacity, but then I'm in there a lot doing things myself. So I kind of, my job is kind of like a PI, a technician, a lab manager, ordering all the supplies and everything. And kind of doing my own side sets of experiments that might be a little too challenging for early scientists. So yeah, it's a balance that I try to find. And right now in the summer, it's a lot easier. It becomes more of a challenge while I'm teaching during the school year, you know, teaching, you know, 1 to 2 classes each semester. But having the students build that independence so that then they're able to carry on their science, carry on their work while I am teaching animal physiology or entomology or something like that, really helps.
Well, that's such a great, like, great experience for the undergrads in the UK, or at least in Oxford. Undergrads, like, undergrad research projects are just typically, like, really short, and it's just things that usually graduate students are too busy to do, or something like a project like that. Very tedious, yeah. Projects. So it's really great to have that sort of flexibility and space for you to really spend a lot of time in the lab and develop all these skills.
And just to like undergrads are capable of so much more than we can give them credit for oftentimes. Like I remember the my graduate lab, a lot of, like the early undergrads who just started, they were like making solutions and washing dishes and sterilizing things. Like that was the major test and like the major role. Whereas there's students, like Ben, the student I mentioned who helped with the PySpy, like I cannot code in Python. He did all of that himself. And to really kind of take advantage of their interests and their skills and use them as a plus, as opposed to looking at them and being like, oh, well, they're not graduate students, not here for the long duration, or a postdoc who's looking to do a career. They are interested and curious, and it's a real, I wish I could physically and mentally be able to take on more students, because they could do so much, but there's only so much of me to go around and to manage.
Yeah, that's so great. What do you think is the most beautiful aspect about biology? This could be about ants or insects or nature.
I mean, I think the most beautiful way is how evolution has selected for things to work and to work really well. And I think being able to look again, to look at an individual ant that's trying to like carry a carcass of a dead animal, another dead insect, and it's just like not strong enough, it's not making much progress. Like to look at that and be like, how could that be successful? How could that work? But then to know that, like, yeah, these insects are one of a few groups that have started this eusocial life where they work together and help each other, and it works so well. And under the surface, ants are one of the most successful species on the planet. To kind of get to that point, that's the exciting, beautiful side of it. The big, I don't want to be a downer here, but the negative side of it is how humans have really messed things up. And to see how we're kind of working against millions and millions of years of evolutionary selection, and how these things that were advantageous are now, not as successful because we have changed the rules of the game a little bit. But finding these natural spaces and just seeing, oh, like here's a plant that relies on ants to disperse its seeds. And there's some ants that get away with this because they will carry the whole seed. And then you have a bunch of like new sprouts of these plants shooting up from where ant colonies are because it's so warm and, nutrient packed in an ant colony. And then there's other ants that just cheat the system. They take the food and leave the seed. Like, it's just so cool how that works and like the arms races that occur in that.
Yeah, all different survival strategies.
Yeah.
One final question. What advice do you have for young scientists?
I guess my biggest advice for young scientists, and it's very personal to me, is to really sample a lot of different fields of science and like find the things that you are most excited for. Like people might talk to you about, oh, you should stay in this field because it's comfortable, or like it, you already have this, knowledge base built up. But if it's not interesting you, days are going to be long and hard. Whereas I was doing all this chemistry research when I was looking at graduate schools, I was kind of like waffling between kind of biochemistry, biology, and chemistry. And I just saw myself thinking about being in a chemistry lab full time. And I was like, this doesn't really do it for me. And I don't think I'd really want to keep up with this. I love all the integrations and the connections and the relations between the science that I now do. And chemistry has a part in that, right? When we think about all these odorants, it's good that I have that knowledge, and it's really good, but it's not something that I needed to stay in that lane. So change lanes a lot and find what you think is going to be a nice drive for the rest of your career. And it's never too late to change.
Greg, this was a really fun conversation. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast and good luck with your research.
Oh, thank you, Paco. It was really great to be on here. Thanks for having me.